Hi, everybody. Today is Friday, July 25th, 2025, and our friend Dmitry Orlov is back with us. Welcome back, Dmitry.
Good to be with you.
Let me start, Dmitry, with before it seems that, I was thinking that if we have some sort of problem with the live stream, yesterday we had it. I don't know what's going on between StreamYard and YouTube. It's somehow We've experienced a problem yesterday, but today is okay, it seems. Dmitry, before starting this talk, let us know how can we support you. And I know that you write a very, every time I read on your website, I see something new, because you're talking about a variety of topics that are so much important for the region and for the Europe, for Russia, for the United States, those people who are interested in the issues related to these regions in the Middle East. How can we support your work?
Go to the URL on your screen and join and read my articles. There are quite a few of them. I've upped it from just a couple of articles, posts a week to three. So right now I have posts there about Europe's clever war plan, which is a joke. It's not really clever at all. And I explain why. There's denazification of Israel. Israel needs to be denazified. And I talk about how that is likely to happen. A really comprehensive article on why sanctions against Russia don't work. The consumption of Europe is a previous article that I wrote. Donald Trump's warfighting abilities is another topic I discuss. So there's a lot there to read, and I hope that you you go there and join and read up on what I produce, which is a lot more information than can be squeezed into an hour's worth of conversation. So hope to see you there.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with that. You have to read. Somehow reading is much deeper than hearing and watching. Dmitry, let me start with the negotiations between the Russian and Ukrainians. And how did you find it? What was the outcome? What were the outcomes of the latest, the third round of negotiations between the two parties?
Well, the most important outcome is that the negotiations or the meeting actually took place. In terms of what transpired, that only took an hour, maybe a little more, a little less. The only things that had to do with actual negotiations had to do with the points, the requirements documents that the two parties produced after the last round of negotiations. And the only thing that was said about them is that the two sides are too far apart for them to be able to discuss anything. So nothing substantive as far as a ceasefire or anything extravagant of that sort was discussed, except for a Russian proposal to have periodic short ceasefires of maybe 12, maybe 24, 48 hours, something like that, so that people could the sanitation crews could remove the dead and the wounded from the battlefield on both sides without interference, which is currently being done, but with great risk. And so the Ukrainians said that they will think about it, which probably means nothing. That is as far as ceasefire talks went. There were also discussions of various humanitarian issues, which is an ongoing discussion and ongoing work. Thousands more dead Ukrainians are going to be delivered to the Ukrainian side from the Russian side. There are 30 people missing from the Kursk region, which were taken perhaps as hostages. So the Russians would like to know what happened to them. Are they hostages, or are they detained for some other reason? Because there's no clarity on that topic. And that's pretty much it. Now, overall, in terms of the format, probably the most important thing to note is that the Ukrainian delegation no longer follows what Zelensky wanted them to do. What Zelensky wanted them to do is to demand an immediate, unconditional ceasefire and direct talks between him, face-to-face talks between him and Putin. And the reaction was, well, why should we have a ceasefire from the Russian side? The reaction was, why should we have a ceasefire? Because we're winning. Why can't we just continue winning? And as far as direct meeting with Putin, well, who is Zelensky? He's not the president because his term is up. And so it's pointless to have discussions with him because any piece of paper he signs is by definition null and void. There's nothing to be negotiated with him. And so that track has been abandoned. So now it's just being polite, humanitarian issues, and talks in Russian instead of this sort of weirdness of Russian-speaking people trying to speak Ukrainian through a translator who translates it to Russian. So they've abandoned that propaganda nonsense. You know, all Ukrainian officials speak to each other in Russian and only speak Ukrainian for the cameras. Everybody knows that. It's not a secret. Why should anybody be embarrassed to speak Russian? Well, they are, and it's ridiculous. But they're no longer doing that. So that's a positive development. That's a bit of reality sort of seeping in, leaking in. Yeah.
We had protests in Ukraine, Dmitry, and on the other hand, we know that Russia is not happy with Zelensky and his administration. They don't recognize Zelensky as the official president of Ukraine. But when you see the way that the protests were managed somehow, you know, after we are approaching 4 years of the conflict in Ukraine, we haven't seen anything like this before. It seems that so much managed, so much coordinated with the people, with somehow some forces in Ukraine. What does that mean for Russia? What is the priority? Is Russia supporting these people? Is Russia somehow considering, is that a positive move in the mind of Russians? Or they see this as something new that could bring more problems to the issue of the conflict between Russia and Ukraine?
Well, it's not protests. Ukrainians do not protest unless they get paid for it. Typically, the price of a protester going out and quote-unquote protesting is equivalent to a monthly salary, average monthly salary. So that is a typical thing that's been going on for a long time. And anytime somebody wants a regime change in Kiev, you just push a button and suddenly you have this AstroTurf protest taking place. And lo and behold, you have regime change, et cetera. Except this time it's not really that serious, because if you look at the people protesting, it's people who didn't vote for Zelensky because they were too young to vote. Everybody there was under 25, which is the draft age. People over 25 would not show up because they're in hiding, or they've been drafted already, because people over 25, men over 25, are afraid of being pulled off the street and stuffed in the trenches, without any training at this point. And it's basically a death sentence for a lot of them. So it was a bunch of young people getting paid. They had these placards on standard bits of cardboard with drawn up with standard pens in standard colors. So clearly all of that stuff was just sent in. And you pick a slogan from a list and write it on a piece of paper in your own handwriting. And then you shout while the camera is at you, and cha-ching, some money arrives on your debit card. That's how it works, you see. And so the people behind it are Klitschko and Poroshenko, the former president and the mayor of Kiev, who think that, you know, Zelensky is not very popular, and so they might actually knock him out and replace him. Not terribly likely at this point. Zelensky did the kind of trivial thing. It was all about him claiming authority over the anti-corruption agencies, two bureaus, which are controlled by the Americans. They were started by the Americans, by the Democrats. They're at each other's throats permanently, and they're also collecting evidence on corruption, and got pretty close to Zelensky, which is why he decided to take them over, because he didn't want them to knock him out of action by shutting down all the people that he depends on for security and for money and for things like that. And so the Americans are very upset about that, because here's a Ukrainian taking over what Americans see as their property, their way of controlling the Ukrainians for you know, successfully or not. And there was a basically a sign-off to Poroshenko and Klitschko to go ahead and organize this, you know, AstroTurf protest, and, you know, kind of see what you can do. Zelensky's response was to offer to cancel the legislation that put him in charge of these two anti-corruption agencies, except that he also sent the Rada, Verkhovna Rada, the parliament, into recess at the same time. So his previous law that he signed into effect remains in effect for now. So nothing has happened. And so that's the thing to point out, that nothing has happened. But overall, you know, in terms of how that changes the picture, it shows that the Ukraine is as politically ridiculous as ever, where you can just summon a demonstration by spending a bit of money. And there are enough rich people in the Ukraine to do that. And people will protest for money and pretty much nothing else. That there's no real politics going on. And the other thing is that with these developments, it's clear that the Ukraine is pretty much abandoning even the pretense of any kind of democratic governance. That it's going to be a dictatorship, it's going to be a junta. The West is going to approve of this junta. It doesn't matter whether Zelensky is the Pinochet type character, or whether Zaluzhny is flown in from London and replaces Zelensky. It would still be just a dictator in charge of a junta, and it kind of points the way for the other European governments, where it is becoming clear in countries such as Germany that democratic tools are no longer effective in keeping the permanent elite in power, that dictatorial means are going to have to be deployed to repress people who vote for AfD, Alternative für Deutschland, and other alternative parties. So it might take a little bit of political repression to get people to wave the right flag, never mind how they vote. because Europe is becoming ungovernable, because people are not very happy with the way things are going. And the elites don't want to lose their jobs because of that. So the Ukrainization of Europe is probably the next step after Ukraine itself becomes a full-blown dictatorship.
When it comes, Dmitry, to who's going to be in power in Ukraine in the aftermath of any Ukrainian settlement, in your opinion, does Europe, or do Europe and the United States together, care about who's going to be in power in Ukraine? In terms of, I would argue that somehow we can see some sort of difference between the United States under the Trump administration and the European position. It seems that the European position is much ideological, but Trump's position is somehow, it's all related to the economy, how they can gain, how they can receive, win or benefit from the case of Ukraine. How are these two going to play out in Ukraine, in your opinion, these two different approaches?
Well, it was Trump is very clever in terms of just one thing, putting pressure on people in a kind of a negotiating process. But his deal making is basically a question of making threats, mostly hollow, but knocking his opponents off balance and using that unbalanced situation to his advantage. That's what he's been doing all his life. He did it wonderfully with respect to Zelensky. He invited Zelensky to the White House. He had a major scandal with him. He threw him out of the White House, giving the Europeans an opening where they invited Zelensky to London and coddled him and supported him and told him that they're going to support him forever and et cetera. And then that was Trump's opening to deal them with the current coup de grace, which is, oh, you want to support Zelensky? Fine. Pay to support Zelensky. Pay us to make the weapons, which you will take from us and give to Zelensky for free. That's going to be the new deal. Didn't you say that you like Zelensky and want to support him? Well, where's the money? And suddenly it turns out that the money is nowhere. Suddenly it turns out that the Europeans are just basically running away as fast as their legs will carry them from this wonderful deal that they've talked themselves into. At first, they were not part of the picture in terms of negotiating some kind of a peaceful settlement, but they wanted to be part of the picture. And now they're part of the picture, but you know, if you want to be part of the picture, you have to pay, and they don't want to pay. They don't have the money. So that's a real victory for Trump, because now if the Ukraine folds, which it will eventually, if it capitulates, which I think is the inevitable outcome, Europe is to blame because they didn't pay up. It's as simple as that. The Americans paid until it became obvious to them that that was pointless. They offered the Europeans to take the ball and run with it. What did the Europeans do? They dropped the ball. Now who's to blame? And so I think it's a major diplomatic victory for Trump. It's a huge diplomatic defeat for Europe. And as far as the Ukraine, well, it's more of the inevitable.
It seems that they're gonna put the blame on, in my opinion, they're gonna put the blame on Germany, because look at Germany and how the country has suffered during the war in Ukraine, the conflict in Ukraine. And after all, nobody seems to be in. Even France said they're not interested in buying new arms, new weapons for Ukraine. They don't have the money to pay it. But if Germany is coming up, Germany is going forward with the demand. And do you feel that somehow if we assume that one day this conflict, as you've mentioned, it cannot go forever. It comes to an end someday. But how about Germany? How can we? It seems that Germany would be the only country, I would argue, in Europe that has suffered the most after Ukraine, and is the one to blame the most. It is somehow unbelievable what's going on with the case of Germany.
Well, I think the Germans are incurable. You would think that their experience in World War II would teach them not to mess with Russia, but what they've learned instead is that even if they lose a war to Russia, the Russians are actually reasonably nice to them afterwards. So it's okay to lose a war to Russia. What they haven't realized that, you know, that was then and this is now, and that Russia sees things rather differently. So Russia's lesson is that if the Germans haven't learned what the lesson that they had to learn from World War II, the next lesson has to be such that they don't even have to learn it. It will be by virtue of the fact that Germany will no longer exist. And so the Germans should really somehow wrap their heads around the idea that a conflict, an armed conflict between Germany and Russia, will be the end of Germany, of the thing that Bismarck started. That it would be the end of German history. You know, there will still be Länder, you know, little ethnic preserves with Germans in them, with no industry, with no army, with no effect on world politics, and probably victimized by all of their neighbors, as was traditional throughout the Middle Ages. So it'll go back to that, because Russia is not going to keep doing this, you know, every 80 years. Forget that, you know. So that's really something that should somehow be communicated to the German population, but unfortunately, there is no effective way of doing that.
I think the relationship between Russia and Germany is somehow totally different from the relationship that we know between Russia and other countries in Europe. Even with, I would argue, with Hungary, with Slovakia, it's not that much considerable, because German economy was somehow feeling so much good for such a long time. Inflation was so low, and all the stability of the German economy is the product of the relationship between Russia and Germany. And Germany has lost that so far. And it doesn't seem that they do care, the leadership in Germany, they do care about what's going on in terms of the economy of Germany, who's going to provide Germany with energy in the near future, what would happen to the German industry. On the other hand, you see they're talking about building their military. And let's assume they go after building their military. Who's going to fight them? Who's going to attack them? Unless they want to attack someone else. They want to attack another country. But what is happening in the mind of, in your view, what's your speculation on what's going on in the mind of these people who are running Germany?
Oh, it's very simple. You know, they had the money laundry in the Ukraine running full steam and were pocketing lots of money that was going through Kiev. They were taking trains to Kiev, coming back with suitcases full of cash. And so that was going really well. But that is drying up. You know, that well is drying up. So they have to come up with some new way of stealing lots of money, as they're now accustomed to doing. And the best way of doing that they can come up with is borrow lots of money and pretend to spend it on arms, on rearmament. But everybody knows that NATO is structured in such a way that nothing actually happens without American involvement. You cannot make anything, a plane, a tank, whatever, without avionics from the United States and without logistical support from the United States. If the United States doesn't want a European country to have a certain technical competence, the United States can pretty much prevent that from happening, no matter how much money is thrown at the problem. And so this is just all a ploy to pocket a whole bunch of borrowed money. This is all it is. It's a corruption scheme. It's not a rearmament scheme. And you're right that Europe has nobody to go to war against. You know, there's the suicide by Russia plan, and they have a lot of these people who should be military people with, you know, lots of, you know, credentials supposedly to their name, talking like, well, we could just knock out Kaliningrad, and not realizing that if say Germany attacks Kaliningrad, then Russia attacks Berlin, and Berlin suddenly ceases to exist. And so that's the trigger, because that is what is written into the Russian defense doctrine. Read it. It's all there. You cannot threaten Russian sovereignty without having your sovereignty destroyed in return. It's as simple as that. And yet these people are pretending that they don't know this. They can't possibly be that ignorant and that stupid. What that tells me is that they know that they're just throwing words to the wind, that none of this is real. This is just a way of lining their pockets.
Dmitry, looking at Europe today, and they're talking about drones. I don't know, they want to send people, mercenaries, maybe official forces to Ukraine to run these drone operation. But is there any sort of grand strategy? Is there any sort of move that could somehow show that Europe wants to go after some sort of security agreement, some sort of stability in the near future when it comes to Ukraine? Or you see some sort of chaos? The policy of chaos is considered in Ukraine. After all, when you look at European leaders, they're talking about what they want for Ukraine is whatever the Ukrainian want. The Ukrainian government wants, Ukrainian people want. But what's in their mind, in your opinion? What do they want from Ukraine? What is the end game for them in Ukraine? Is there any sort of end game, or they're just somehow they're finding some place like Afghanistan that they can continue for 20 years, then say, no, it's not working, we're going to get back, we're going to go home? How is that? How do they see Ukraine today?
I have no idea. I really don't think that they have a very good understanding of what's happening, of the processes that's happening within the former Ukraine. I think that they are very far away from realizing what the future holds. Instead, they create the future kind of as they go along, and then they scrap it, and they create a new future, then they scrap it too. So Macron will talk about some kind of an expeditionary force, and then it'll just vanish, and then there'll be some new idea, and it'll just vanish. And in the meantime, you know, there are things happening on the ground, and they're ignored. Such as French Rafale planes, that very old ones that they gave to the Ukrainians, falling out of the sky on kind of a semi-regular basis. But they won't talk about it because that's bad news, and they don't want bad news. So there isn't really any kind of a reality in terms of what's happening in the Ukraine. What will happen in the Ukraine is the Ukrainian retreat from the contact line with the Russians will accelerate. It has already accelerated. It will continue to accelerate. There will be long patches of the front line that will be just completely free of Ukrainian forces, because the soldiers are refusing to go there. They're refusing orders. That is happening right now in Pokrovsk, which is actually Krasnoarmeysk. So the Russians can pretty much walk in. So there will be more and more and more cities where the Russians pretty much announce where they're going, and the Ukrainians withdraw to make room. And how much of that will continue happening is up to the Russians, not up to the Ukrainians. The Russians will grab all the territory that they want in terms of creating a buffer zone, in terms of protecting what they consider actual Russian, constitutional Russian territory at this point. So that means Sumy region, that means Kharkiv region, that means Dnipropetrovsk region, various other regions. What happens with Nikolaev and Odessa is a different question, separate issue of cutting the Europeans and the Ukrainians off from the Black Sea as much as possible, and building a bridge to Transnistria and Moldova. So that's a different issue, different strategic consideration. But that's what's happening. That's what's going to be happening in the Ukraine in the future. The other issue is that, you know, it's a society in shock in the Ukraine, and they have been horribly repressed. But at some point, people do realize that they have nothing left to lose, and must do something, or that they realize that they lose everything if they do nothing. But if they do something, they might stand a chance. And so what that would mean is that there will be a civil war within the Ukraine itself. And the people who perpetuated this disaster will actually be held responsible or pay in real ways for the disaster that they've caused. And so that is something that I see happening, but I don't know when. The problem is that Ukrainian society, Ukrainian culture and local traditions are such that people try to stay away or stay out of any sort of a public-minded initiative. Everybody is ultimately selfish there. And so a whole country of very selfish people is unlikely to make common cause with each other. They would sooner die than help their neighbors. That is the mentality. And so it may take a really long time, or it may actually never happen, and people will just run away or hide or refuse to participate, etc. That is another possibility that I see.
We have the corridor between Azerbaijan and Armenia.
Zangezur
corridor. What is the importance of this corridor, and do you feel that the United States gonna somehow run this corridor and get being in charge of this corridor is somehow important for Russia and Iran as well, and for the region, I would argue. But how is that going to play out in the mind of the United States? It seems that Donald Trump wants all together, wants to manage the situation there. Is that coming? Is that how can we expect any sort of reaction from Iran or Russia, in your opinion?
Well, it's sort of fake news that America is going to run Zangezur Corridor. It's just some journalist came up with it and threw it out there, and then the Americans are, you know, their reaction is, what? Haven't heard about that. So that's a funny situation. But in terms of what that corridor is a chunk of Armenia that splits Azerbaijan in two pieces, and has a border with Iran, so that the Iranians can go to Armenia, which is a Christian country, not a Muslim country, so they can drink themselves silly and gamble and have relations with women with moderately low social consciousness and just generally have fun. I guess it's important for a certain contingent of Iranians, because it's not very close to Tehran, but it can be reached. You can drive there, and you can have fun, and you can come back, etc. So it's pretty popular with Iran. Not on a high political level. I don't think that the supreme leader is particularly in favor of that whole thing. But it's an outlet. It's a way for people to blow off steam. So maybe it's valuable that way. In terms of what it means to Armenia, well, Armenia would lose its border with Iran if that corridor goes away. What it means for Azerbaijan is that Azerbaijan would suddenly have a direct land connection to Turkey. And Azerbaijan would kind of slowly become part of Turkey, and the two countries with very similar traditions and languages and religion, etc., would sort of start merging. But it would complicate, if the two countries merged, it would multiply the ethnic divisions within Azerbaijan/Turkey by a large number, because Azerbaijan, just like Turkey, is not a nation. Well, it may be a nation. It has huge other nationalities embedded into it. And unlike Persia and unlike Russia, it is not a civilization. It pretends to be a nation state, a Turkish nation state, that kind of tries to absorb or exclude everybody else. And so that doesn't really seem to me like a rational approach. And I think the reaction from Turkey is, on the one hand, they want to grow their domain by kind of strapping on this Azerbaijan thing, but on the other hand, they're thinking that maybe that's worth more trouble than it's more trouble than it's worth. You have to keep in mind that Azerbaijan is like a lot of former Soviet socialist republics, like the Ukraine, is a communist Bolshevik creation. It was slapped together out of lots of little kingdoms with different traditions and different languages and different ethnic groups, some of which to this day don't really like being part of Azerbaijan. They're not Azeri Turks. There are lots of other things. The entire north of Azerbaijan is really Dagestan, and Dagestan is this very diverse place, just a bunch of tribes. So there are lots of ways to kind of push Azerbaijan in the direction of just exploding. And if Turkey and Azerbaijan are joined together, then Turkey would explode next. So I don't think that that's a stable or a nice situation. Now, what the Americans have been doing with Pashinyan, Nikol Pashinyan, the president of Armenia, who is a Soros trainee, is destroy Armenia and basically just wipe it out. And they succeeded in doing that. Armenia has so far surrendered a lot of territory that was historically Armenian territory. Well, actually, historically Russian territory, because Russia purchased it from Persia, paid for it. But now suddenly Armenia is giving it back to Azerbaijan and exiling all the Armenians that lived there for generations. So there are lots of this decay of Armenia going on. Armenia is dying. More Armenians live outside Armenia than in Armenia, and the ones that live in Armenia, I'm not that impressed with them, let's be honest, because my feeling is that if they could have left Armenia, they would have. Maybe there's something that is preventing them from leaving Armenia, which is not to their advantage and not to Armenia's advantage either. So anyway, Armenia is kind of dying, I think. It's disintegrating. And I wouldn't be surprised if Zanguzur goes over to the Azerbaijani side, but I don't think that's going to be a good thing for Azerbaijan or for Turkey in the medium term.
Dmitry, Turkey is somehow a very interesting player in the region. When it comes to Syria, when it comes to Azerbaijan, when it comes to what's going on in Gaza, do you see any strategy, any sort of mindset that can be somehow understood by the other countries about Turkey? Because somehow they say something, they do something different. When it comes to Russia, I would argue, when it comes to Iran, you know what would be their move, you know, because they're talking about it. They're so simple about what they want, what they have in their mind. But when it comes to Turkey, it's so tricky. You don't know what do they want, you know, what would be the reaction on the part of the Turkish government, what are they seeking for in Azerbaijan, in Armenia, in the Middle East. How can we understand the behavior of the Turkish government? Is that all about the benefit for Turkey? I would argue that's not the case. That has not been the case so far.
Well, Turkey is what came together after a gigantic failure of the Ottoman Empire, which spectacularly disintegrated. And at the end of the Ottoman Empire, what was going on is lots and lots and lots of backstabbing. Everybody was backstabbing everybody else. Two Ottomans together means three traitors, that sort of thing. And so that's how it fell apart, and then it came together as a new entity, new nationalist entity under Atatürk, Kemal Atatürk, and that is sort of a front that is one half of the story. The other half of the story is Islamist. So there are links with the Muslim Brotherhood, which was supported by the Turkish government, and so it's kind of a fine balance between the secular Atatürk tradition and this Muslim fundamentalist tradition, and they're constantly in opposition to each other. And the other thing is that it used to be that the Americans could overthrow any Turkish government they wanted anytime they wanted to do so. And the last time they tried it with Erdogan, it didn't work because the Russians warned Erdogan, because the Russians, the way they deal with Turkey is following the dictum of keep your friends closer and your enemies even closer. So here's a nation of backstabbers on your southern border, pretty much, that you have to deal with because it's a big, important nation, and you have to understand what's going on there and be prepared for it to stab you in the back any time. And when that happens, you have to take it in stride, not overreact, realize that that's what's been happening forever, and just roll with it. And so now the Americans don't have the ability to overthrow Erdogan anytime they want, and they took a step back. So Erdogan is an unusually long-lived leader because of Putin, pretty much.
You've mentioned one of your articles is how to denazify Israel. Is that the problem? Is that the main problem with Israel and what's going on in the region?
Well, look, there isn't much of a problem with Jews around the world. I mean, look at Iran, right? Iran is pretty much at war, permanently at war with Israel, but there are Jews happily living within Iran. There are lots of synagogues. The Jews are represented in the parliament. They have a seat in the Iranian parliament. They're respected. The Judaism is regarded as extremely important to Islam. There's an understanding that there's a kind of a cross-fertilization that happened between various religious traditions. And so Jews are very much respected as part of the Persian civilization. And that is the case in a lot of other countries as well. And then you have Zionists, which are currently committing genocide in Gaza, and settlers who are destroying Palestinian homes and stealing their land. And this is an outrage, not just for everybody in the world, but for the Jews themselves. There are a lot of Jews around the world that absolutely detest Israel because it's not really a Jewish state. It's a kind of a Nazi state. Jewish-based Nazis, just like you had German-based Nazis or Spanish Nazis. So that is something that is an outrage to the world, Jews included, and eventually it's going to crash and burn because everybody knows that the only reason Israel can maintain itself is because of lots and lots of American money and support. And that is not going to run forever.
Dimitri, you mentioned the case of Gaza. We know that Emmanuel Macron has written a letter to Mahmoud Abbas. He said that France gonna recognize the state of Palestine, which was somehow had reaction from the Secretary of State in the United States, Marco Rubio. He attacked France, and Macron said that that's not the sort of move to be acceptable for the United States. How do you feel the way that somehow what's going on in Gaza is changing the mindset of those countries who were supporting Israel for such a long time? You see, even in the United Kingdom, we know how they support what's going on in Gaza, how they send weapons and everything. But there is some sort of pressure from the community, from the public opinion going to the government. It's all over Europe. You see, the public opinion is totally somehow against Israel and what Israel is doing. But you don't see that sort of pronunciation in the way that their leaders are behaving. Is that going to change? Is this sort of recognition, the France recognition of the state of Palestine, is that going to be a moment of sanity for Europe?
No, I don't think so. I don't expect any sanity out of Macron. I think Macron basically tries to come up with talking points that don't involve his absolute complete failure as far as French society and economy. You know, he would rather talk about anything other than the falling standard of living of the French people and the decaying infrastructure and the amount of crime especially crime by people from other places that goes on in France. And so this is another talking point for him. It's controversial, it may very well happen that everybody will talk about it and then they'll forget about it. There are lots of things like that being thrown around in the world, like Canada becoming the 51st state, or that Greenland joining the United States. I could rattle off lots and lots of these talking points that came and went. And I would be surprised if 2 weeks from now Macron is still talking about it. He'll find something else to talk about.
Thank you so much, Dimitri, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always. Before leaving the live, how can we support your work?
Please go to my blog, subscribe, and read, by the way, on the denazification of Israel. That's a long article with lots of detail in it, with lots of comments that people have contributed to clarify and to add to it. So I hope that you go there and avail yourself of that resource because it is becoming a quite a useful resource, I feel. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Dimitri. See you soon.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.